Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi everyone, this is Barney Leventino at Syosset Library.
And this is Lisa Hollander.
And we're here for another chapter of our podcast, Turn the Page. And we're thrilled today to have as our guest, Tom Montalbano. And Tom, I have to tell you that when we first started talking about doing the podcasting, you know, a lot of my focus here in the library is local history. And I said, you've got to be our first guest. So here you are, and we're thrilled to have you. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you. I'm honored.
For those of you who are not aware of who Tom is a local resident, lifelong resident, and an author and a historian, and we're going to now bounce it over to you and start telling us about how you became the chronicler of Syosset.
Okay. Interestingly, the last time I was down here, I believe I was sitting in, well, it was a little bit different, but we were recording old people from Syosset, doing an oral history program with Isabel Goldenkopf, who was the local history librarian at the time. And I was in my late 20s, I suppose, and sitting here with a head full of rock and roll hair, interviewing these people who were maybe probably 50 at the time, and thinking how old they were and telling these old stories from the early 1900s. And now I'm the old guy sitting in the chair. And Do you want to start with that?
That goes back. You did. That was early in the 90s, wasn't it?
That was 1990 and 91.
I was still in high school.
You were still in high school.
Syosset High School.
Yeah, Lisa is also a lifelong Syosset resident.
Yes,
so
yes.
You guys share a connection.
Yeah, I was born in Syosset Hospital.
Okay.
In the 70s.
I was actually born in Brooklyn. Well, I guess we're going back a little bit further.
Yeah.
I was born in Brooklyn, but the family lived in Syosset. My father had bought an $18,000 corner house in the development known as Clearview Village. And I think he may have used a GI loan, like a lot of the people did at the time. So a lot of the people who came here originally were from Brooklyn and from Queens. Mm-hmm. And on the south side of Syosset had been all farms. And in the late 40s, we had the golden nematode was a blight that came and destroyed all the farms down there. So as soon as that started happening, the developers came around, started knocking on farmers' doors, and do you want to sell? Do you want to sell? And everybody was like, absolutely. You know, where do I sign? So all that became brand new neighborhoods. The north had already been developed. The south was just up and coming. And everybody was from Brooklyn and Queens, and we all spoke like this. Let's go to the park, get a piece of pizza. And, but there wasn't much connection with the town itself, because everyone had come from somewhere else. There wasn't an old man, you know, down the block that you're saying, go ask Fred, he knows everything, he's been here forever. So we kind of, it was our own little world over there, and we kind of grew up not having a sense of place as people in the north of Syosset, I later learned, did. We moved out for a little while. My father got a brochure for a place called Rio Rancho in New Mexico, and I guess he had gotten tired of Syosset already, and went out there, and we saw that it was just a model house and a lot of desert around it, so we came back here and bought a house in North Syosset, and it was quite different. On the south, we used to go out in the morning at like 8 o'clock in the morning. You'd just leave the house, you'd go play with your friends in the park, and you'd be gone all day, and you'd come home for dinner, you know, where you been, you know.
Yeah, like that's how we grew up on Long Island. We'd leave in the morning and come home at dinner, and somewhere along the way, somebody's mom would give you lunch.
There you go. By 10 years old, we were taking our bicycles and riding on the sidewalks to Roosevelt Field, which is a big schlep from here.
Yes.
Schlep was a Long Island word, by the way.
You're talking north and south. Like, for people that are not familiar with the area, what's the... The geographical boundary.
Would you say Jericho?
Jericho Turnpike was always the dividing point. Yeah. We even had a South and a North Syosset Little League.
You know, I remember that.
Bitter rivals in those days. In the South, again, I would say you didn't really have that sense of a community. But when I moved here, first we moved to Split Rock Road, and the first thing I remember is seeing a deer run across the road and hearing chickens clucking at night coming from a neighbor's yard. And this was like, where did we move? What are we doing here? You know, but as I started to meet people, I noticed that there were people who had been here for generations. And I went to school, and there was the Williams family and the Kennedy family. And they'd all been here for three, four generations. And there was really a feeling like they had roots, you know, deep here. Mm-hmm. And that was maybe the beginning of a feeling of community for me. And I tried to get involved in it in a lot of different ways. And finally, it wasn't cool in high school, really, to be a historian or, you know, to be into that. And the way we learned history in those days, they never really brought it home. So you studied the Revolutionary War, and it was always something that was happening someplace else. It happened in Virginia or Boston. And you never really realized that it was happening here, even though we have Raynham Hall and Oyster Bay and, yeah. mm-hmm. and all kinds of landmarks here, you know, right. of big points in history. So when the library announced that it was going to do an oral history program here, I jumped on it. I had some experience with audio, and I was a musician, and I volunteered to record the interviews. And I kind of thought that I saw they had equipment that wasn't so great at the time, and I said, let's do this right and make sure that it's around. And so I dragged all this stuff. In those days, it was, today we're recording here for anyone who's not listening, on a box that's the size of, you know, like an old cassette tape. Razor or something. But in those days, I dragged in a whole room full of equipment and sat here with headphones and big microphones and started listening to people speak. And not only were they weren't just talking about themselves so much, but they were talking about people who had been here that I'd kind of read about. Like we had the big estates in Syosset and right. Muttontown. These were people who were historical figures who had bought these mansions in the area, and I'd only read about them as if, again, they lived on Mars or something. But they're saying, yeah, you know, Jimmy Burden, he was, oh, that guy was crazy. You know, they used to have these parties at the house, and they would drive the cars into the swimming pool. And all these people from the Great Gatsby and all of
that. That's exactly what I was just thinking, yeah, Gatsby.
they came to life. They were real people. Suddenly.
Fox hunts through town and
yes.
all of that.
They would talk about the fox hunts right. where they would blow the whistle, and all the kids would have to get off the street because the dogs were coming through. And it was like, wow, this is really like a place that you would have read about in an old book. Mm-hmm. And they would talk about shopkeepers. You'd go into the stores, and you know, the guy would take you around the store and grab things and put them in the bag and measure your butter and your cheese and all. And it was a completely different thing. And I just kind of, at that point, I think I was just hooked. They made history real for me. So I got very interested at that point.
Yeah, that program that you guys did, the Oral History Project, for years we had it on cassettes here, and then a couple of years ago we actually transferred it to DVD, and we've shown it a bunch of times, and people still love it. They clamor for it every time we show it. They come down, and we added there's images now that are attached to it where you were involved with in creating the audiovisual program.
Well, there were two components of it. There were the interviews. We right. interviewed about 15 or 20 people and then took sound bites and did a slideshow. Mm-hmm. It was an automated slideshow called the Syosset Story.
And that's what we now have on DVD. And people still come in. They check it out and they love it.
Yeah, well, picture that when we first did it, they did two showings at the library, I think, a week apart, and they had to do two each day. So because the people were just lined up outside the library to right. see this, it was an automated slideshow. It moved by itself. It had music and sound effects, and people just loved it mm-hmm. at that time. I don't think it's translated well to DVD.
And actually, you know, it works out okay because we've okay. shown it, as I said, a couple of times when we do local history programs, and it flows nicely. It works okay. great. And we tacked on at the end of it on the DVD the film of the fox hunting from the
wow.
20s.
Okay.
So people love that too.
Yeah, and these were things that the people who we did the interviews with, and I'm saying we because I was basically the audio engineer, but Isabel Goldenkopf was from Port Washington, I believe. She was not from here, and she would start out asking questions. You didn't always know, so I'd be passing notes to her, like, you know, mm-hmm. ask them about that. Da, da, da. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of, you know, I apologize, but I've kind of made it my own, like it was a wee thing. But anyway, so the where were we? We were talking about the Syosset Story,
right?
The video. The quotes from the people that are in the actual video, just some of them are just priceless. People tell stories when you take just a little piece where they would tell you a story about something that happened 100 years earlier that they heard from their grandparent, or mm-hmm. and it was just great to listen to. And then when we did the showings, people who had done the interviews showed up, and their families showed up, and it was just like the conversation never ended at the end. So It's one of those things I always felt good about, and I wanted to do more after that. So I guess we can move along, and we'll probably get into those.
Yeah, well, that led to you again. As I said, you're our go-to guy. When people come in asking us questions about what happened in Syosset way back when, we send them oftentimes to your book. And how'd the book come about?
The book, I think you mean the...
the Syosset story, okay.
That wasn't even the first one, because right after the Syosset story that we did here, I stayed involved with all the people we had spoken to, and I used to see them in town, and we'd talk, and they started talking about the railroad. And I got really interested in the Syosset Railroad Station as the center of the downtown area, and went back and started just reading up on the railroad. And there was a lot. There were people who had kept records of and photographs, and I would go out to Stony Brook, all over the place, and decided I wanted to do a piece just on the railroad. And it turns out that the railroad was basically the beginning of the downtown area. I mean, before that, it was all farms. Can we get into that?
Sure.
It was all farms, and there was really no reason for farmers to do any kind of marketing outside of Syosset. They would trade with each other, and that everybody kind of could sustain themselves with what they grew or raised on the farm.
And they grew mostly potatoes?
Potatoes came a little bit later. It was corn, it was cabbage, it was that type of thing. Potatoes came a little bit later because there was the Irish immigration here. There was the Irish potato blight in the mid-1800s. And when the Irish came over, they had this hunger for potatoes, and they brought it with them. And the local farmers discovered potatoes, and they realized that they could actually transport these things. It wasn't like a head of lettuce that if you didn't get it to where it was going within a day or so, it would rot, and that was the end of it. So a potato could sit on a truck or whatever for weeks. So it was perfect when the train came along, and I'll back up and give you the train story. The Long Island Railroad had made its way across Long Island in 1834 is when they started building that. The idea was to build a route from Brooklyn or Manhattan up to Boston, and they couldn't do it along the Connecticut coastline because it was too rocky and hilly. So they decided, let's go through this piece of land here where nobody lives, no one's going to bother us. We'll just run the track right through the middle, and you know, if they ask any questions, then we'll deal with it. And they ran it through. It went all the way out to Greenport. It reached there by 1844. And so now anybody could transport farm goods or any kind of anything that they were selling from Brooklyn to Greenport, Long Island, then take a ferry across to Stonington, Connecticut, and then take another train up to Boston, and they could get their goods. We were still trading with England at that time. A lot of things were going overseas. So it kind of opened up new markets for farmers. And suddenly everybody wanted a piece of this railroad. The Jones family, which they're all over Long Island, but there was in Cold Spring Harbor, they had a booming whale oil business going.
The Whaling Museum, right?
So the closest train station to them was Hicksville, which was 1837, I believe, opened Hicksville. So in order to get anything onto the railroad, they had to take horse and buggy, you know, over to Hicksville and get it there, get it on the train, and get back in the dark and the whole thing. So they were kind of a money family, and the whale oil industry was kind of starting to wane a little bit because there were other forms of energy coming in. They decided, you know, the only way we're going to survive is we're going to cut our expenses. We're going to bring the railroad from Hicksville into Cold Spring Harbor, and they got a whole bunch of their wealthy friends together and said, "Give us some money. We're going to do this, and it'll help you. It'll help us." They started building. They got as far as Syosset in July of 1854, and all of a sudden they realized, "Wait a second, these hills are too big. We can't." You know, they're right beyond Syosset. You have what they call the West Hills.
Right.
And it was just, they couldn't get through it any further. So they stopped right there, and Syosset was now the end of the line. So, and it wasn't called Syosset. I've been saying Syosset all along. At the time, it was called Eastwoods, was the name that was originally used here in Syosset. So all of a sudden now, people are like, what do we do? If we can use the train, we can run the train this far, why don't we make Syosset the terminus of the line for this, you know, for now. And suddenly all the farmers from around the area were coming in with their horses and wagons and bringing goods to Syosset to ship them out. And in those days, getting here on by horse and wagon was not like getting in your car and you can do it any time of day and come back. It was a big hike to get up hills, like from, you know, they would come from East Norwich, they'd come from Oyster Bay, Huntington, and at the end of the day it would be dark and they'd have to have a place to stay. So they would come into Syosset and drop off the goods and it would be like, all right, where's the hotel? So now all of a sudden you had a hotel open in Syosset. And then you had another hotel open, but they had to also eat when they got there. So there'd be a restaurant, there'd be a bar, and everybody drank liquor in those days because you didn't have pure water. So the saloons became a big thing in Syosset as well. You also had stagecoaches would spring up all over. We had a couple of stagecoach services would take people from Cold Spring Harbor, from Huntington, from Oyster Bay, into Syosset. And it became like this booming little area over here. Where it had just been wheat fields, and they used to call it buckwheat. It was kind of a derogatory thing. I don't know why it was, because we had a lot of buckwheat fields. Did you want to ask a question?
No, keep okay. going. This is fascinating.
It is very.
I don't know how long people want to just hear me go on. The railroad actually had a lot to do with the name. I mentioned that it was originally Eastwoods. It was part of the Robert Williams purchase of 1648. He had bought a swath of land from from Punyapan, who was the leader of the Matinacock Indians at that point, for some cloth and, you know, whatever it was, beads and there. They didn't really have currency at that point, but that included part of Jericho, Woodbury, and Syosset. And they actually called this Eastwoods, and you know there's a Southwoods. We have a Southwoods Middle School, so that area was actually called Southwoods. And they had different, you know, regional names for the different areas. But it never really mattered what you called it, because there wasn't really mail service, and there wasn't really any reason to have a name for a town, except you'd get a letter from overseas or from family someplace. It would be usually addressed to Oyster Bay. So there was a point, I did some research with John Hammond, who's the town of Oyster Bay historian, about the origin of the name Syosset. People always assumed that it was based on this Indian word Suwasset, and myself included.
Is that between the trees? Is that what it was always
place,
said?
Place in the pines.
Place in the pines.
And it turns out it was the original name for Port Jefferson was Suwasset. I even put this in the book we're talking about, The Images right. of America, Syosset, because you write what you know at the time, actually. But since then, I've done research with John Hammond, who's just an amazing, he's the town historian, he's just an encyclopedia of all these things. And we found this old captain's log. If you go back to the 1600s, the Europeans came over, the Dutch and the English, there were a lot of disputes over who owned Long Island. And you can see how it happened, because the Indians, the Native Americans at the time, we tend to think that we just, you know, bulldozed them into selling property. They were kind of shrewd, because there are actually records of them selling a piece of property in the morning to the English and then selling the same piece of property in the afternoon to them. They would say, like, you know, yeah, you want to buy it? Yeah, give me some cigars. And then the Dutch would come in the afternoon. Yeah, you want it? Sure. They didn't have a concept of land ownership. So to them, sure, it's yours. You can have it. And then eventually, you know, we told them they had to get off, and that's when problems began there. But earlier than that, the Dutch and the English disputed this area called, which we now know as Oyster Bay. And we're talking about the harbor in Oyster Bay and the actual town.
Right.
So the Dutch had a name for it that was named after, it was their word for sheriff, which if you say it in Dutch, it spelled, the earliest English translations of this captain's log spell it S-C-H-O-U-T-S. And if you ask a Dutch person to pronounce that, it comes out like schacht. it's harder than Hebrew to say that. So it sounds. So over the years, this log was rewritten, was translated into English histories of the era, because the winner, of course, gets to tell the story later. And we watched over 200 years, it went from this word schacht to a spelling where it says that Captain Tienhoven sends ships into Syosset's Bay. It's spelled S-I-O-C-I-T-S, mm-hmm. Bay. And I guess you know, if you're an Englishman, that's probably the best spelling you can come up with for, you know. This was around 1840. This came out in a history of New Amsterdam, and it was with that spelling. So 1846, the people of Oyster Bay, meaning the hamlet that we know now, had gotten a little bit tired of their name, and there was also some problems with the mail, because there was Oyster Bay up in the north, and the area we now know as Massapequa was South Oyster Bay.
Right.
So mail would be going back and forth, and, you know, I didn't get my birthday card. Oh, it must have gone to South Oyster Bay. So a group of residents got together and decided they were going to change the name. And there was kind of at the time, a lot of Long Island towns were changing their names to reflect the Indian heritage. Of course, you know, you had like Montaukett and all these, and they were going back to the earliest records they could find of Indian names. Somebody, and there's a bit of speculation here, but there were other documents that where this name started, they started spelling this name as Syosset's. But somebody decided that this is what the Dutch called it. It must be based on an Indian name. It sounds Indian, Syosset's, you know, Montaukett, Pawtucket, and all that. So they decided they were going to change the name of Oyster Bay Hamlet to Syosset. And the spelling they used was the one we know now, S-Y-O-S-S-E-T. And from 1846 to 1849, Oyster Bay was called Syosset.
Interesting.
And there are actually maps drawn up where you see the whole area's got, because Eastwoods was a little tiny dot on the map at the time, but Syosset was already the place where Town Hall was. You know, the town of Oyster Bay began like right from the beginning where it is now. But that was the biggest town around here, and everyone knew it as Syosset. So the railroad comes through, and as I said, they stalled in this area called Eastwoods. They needed to put a name on the station now, and it probably, but of course this could change, you know, in a couple of years we could find out something else. Looked at the map and saw Syosset, the way you name like Los Angeles Airport is in a place called, I think, Inwood, and you know they're never exactly where they are, but you name it after the closest big city. So from that point on, it was July 5th. It was around the opening of the railroad was July 3rd. Or they had a ceremony. I think it was July 5th, 1854. They named it Syosset, and all the newspapers said, you know, Syosset, and they never used the word Eastwoods again. Mm-hmm. What I should have mentioned earlier was that in 1849 they changed the name of Oyster Bay back of Syosset.
I was about to ask you that. When did Oyster Bay become Oyster Bay?
They changed it back. They there were some landowners that said they should have been consulted, and how could you do this without us? And they fought back and they changed it back. But the maps had already been drawn, and it was all over the place. Syosset businesses that listed their addresses Syosset. So that's how the railroad has a lot to do with, you know, with the naming of our little hamlet here. And by the way, there's no record in the town of Oyster Bay history of this, because Syosset was never incorporated. That's why it's only a hamlet. It's not considered a town or a village. And so if you go through all the town of Oyster Bay records, is the earliest sighting of the name Syosset lists is in 1846, so it refers to Oyster Bay Syosset. But there's nothing, no mention of the change of the name or...
That's probably why we don't really have like an official anniversary of Syosset, because one really knew when it was that all happened.
Well, it would be 1854.
Right.
1855, the Postal Service opened up a post office here, and they named it Syosset. In those days, a post office was in a general store usually, and the first one was in the general store belonged to Philetus Ketchum. You probably know the Ketchum name from all over Long Island. They were all over this area as well. He was a prominent store owner. He had a store. There's no real record of where the store was, except that it was right adjacent to the train station. And the original train station, if you know the area, it wasn't where it is now, but it was at, if you know where Willis Avenue crosses Underhill Boulevard, that used to continue, and you can see that it continues still. Like, you cross Underhill Boulevard, and Willis Avenue continues on toward Jackson Avenue. So there used to be a station right at that junction of what's now Railroad Avenue.
Yes.
And Willis Avenue. Wasn't really a station. It was basically the general store was there selling tickets, and people just got on the train. The train was at street level in those days.
That was Ketchum's general store.
It's the earliest one there's really record of. There was also a hotel by a gentleman named Peter Bell, who had a hotel in Hicksville originally, and he decided to cash in on the railroad in Syosset and built one in that same area. That one, there was a that was around, I guess what's now Walters Avenue. It goes if you go along Willis. Is Walters Avenue the one that comes out of?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So that would be at the far end of Walters Avenue, not the Jackson Avenue end. But that would have been where the original hotel was, and that's where people would come in. They would use the train, and they would stay at the hotel. They would buy their tickets or buy the newspaper or whatever in that store. Mm-hmm. And so the train later moved down the road. We can get to that.
When did the Ciro Wire? There was another, right? There was another station that was further. Closer to Hicksville, right?
That was what they called the Landia station. It wasn't really a station. It was there was in the during the war year, during World War II years, which was the 1940s. We suddenly had Syosset was filled with defense factories, and it went from downtown Syosset all the way out to what's now Robbins Lane and all the area around. There's I think it's called the Syosset Atrium off Jericho Turnpike.
Oh, yes,
there's a big Grumman
yes.
facility yeah. over there. And over on Robbins Lane, where I don't want to make a time bomb out of this, but right now in 2018, there's a Lifetime Fitness Center, and it's there's probably a name for the shopping center over there, but it's adjacent to the railroad tracks on the would be the west side of Robbins Lane. There was a factory owned by Fairchild Industries, and they made like radios and cameras for the military, and it was a big draw. People were coming out here from Queens to work here. I think they had a factory originally in Jamaica, and they wanted to get people out here to work. But people didn't really have cars if they lived in the city, so they said they lobbied the Long Island Railroad to build a station over there, and it was just basically a stop. It was just a flat platform. They called it Landia. That was, I want to say 1953. Sometimes these numbers are in my head. Sometimes they're not, but
yeah, that's funny. I don't think people realize the extent of the defense industry that was in this area at the time. And I go back to there's a photograph of, I guess it was a World War II photo of the Syosset officials on top of the building with the binoculars and the Civil Air Patrol helmet looking out, I guess, for German bombers.
Yeah. Well, that was on top of the roof of a building that now has, well, it's the corner of, and I wish we had a map here because I'm drawing blanks, but it's a tall building. There's the big bank. Maybe this is Walters Avenue. It's the one just before you hit the triangle, the first triangle. There's a big brick building over there.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
What's the name of the street?
I'm thinking of that area, but I can't remember what the name of it is.
So if you're heading north on Jackson Avenue, you're coming through town and you hit the first big triangle. There's where Cold Spring Road goes off to the right, mm-hmm. and you go towards Split Rock and Berry Hill. There's the first street on the left. There's a big brick building, mm-hmm. and that had started out. That was it was originally an auto repair shop, and what happened was there were Krebs and Schultz were kind of some. They were very well known people around Syosset eventually, but they had started a little station in what's the triangle. No, that's not
that's
it.
That's not it. Okay.
Barney's showing me a picture inside in the book, and it's not exactly the spot. But I think we might have given them a good idea.
Yes.
So they had started an auto repair shop in what's now the triangle, where there's a big gas station. And when they started to expand, they decided they were going to move over across the street. And they started building this big brick building. It was going to be a shop where they sold DeSoto Plymouths. That was the other thing that was big in Syosset. They were selling automobiles when they were first popular, when the GIs were coming back from the war and were looking to get out beyond Syosset. This was before that. They had the foresight to know that automobiles were going to be big. But just when they built this building, all of a sudden, America got involved in World War II. And there was a company called REF that was training people to build, to do sheet metal work for airplanes and just military weaponry. They approached Krebs and Schultz. They said, "All right, before you open, we'd like to rent this building. We want to use it. We need it for the war effort." And in those days, everyone wanted to be part of the war effort.
Right.
So they gave them the building, And that became the first defense factory right in downtown Syosset. So you had people in, pouring in and out of there all day long. And that, yeah.
Yeah, that's the building, right?
Okay. Yep. So that building also, the picture you're talking about, mm-hmm. it's been seen in, I think, a couple of different books written about Syosset. There was a Syosset air lookout patrol or whatever. It was basically, I think it was kind of a political thing. If you were one of these people chosen to do it, you know, you got your picture in the paper and all. But they would sit on top of the roof and they would look out at the sky waiting for enemy planes. And it wasn't so far-fetched because we had the defense factories in town. You had that and you had a Grumman plant now building up. And so we were really a target. And So even at night, they used to turn all the lights out in town. You couldn't have your lights on. You had blackouts after certain hours because they thought the enemy planes were just prowling the skies looking for targets. So that's where the picture was taken. Other defense, I think we mentioned Grumman, we mentioned Fairchild. But it was a very big business, and it also built the town up even more because you had mm-hmm. people who came to work had to go to lunch someplace and you know, had to buy this and buy that. So all of a sudden you had shops opening up all around town. You had luncheonettes. You had what used to be a large hotel in the middle of town, which was originally owned by, a couple of people, but you may know it as the Boslett Hotel.
Yes.
The Boslets are still around Syosset. Most people refer to it by that name. But that became a restaurant, and it was the place for all the defense workers to go at lunchtime. And So picture this downtown area that's now kind of empty in 2018 just being a really booming little suburb for a long time based on defense.
This concludes part one of our discussion with Tom Montalbano. Part two of our discussion will air in the next chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.